This is Audible.
Penguin Audio presents No Easy Day, the autobiography of a Navy SEAL by Mark Owen with Kevin Maurer, read by Holder Graham. Author's note. When I was in junior high school in Alaska, we were assigned a book report. We had to pick a book we liked. Moving down the row of books, I stumbled upon Men in Green Faces by former SEAL Gene Wentz. The novel chronicled missions in Vietnam's Mekong Delta. Full of ambushes and firefights, it centered on the hunt for a rogue North Vietnamese colonel. From page one, I knew I wanted to be a SEAL. The more I read, the more I wanted to see if I could measure up. In the surf of the Pacific Ocean during training, I found other men just like me, men who feared failure and were driven to be the best. I was privileged to serve with and be inspired by these men every day. Working alongside them made me a better person. After 13 consecutive combat deployments, my war is over. This book is closure for that part of my life. Before leaving, I wanted to try and explain what it was that motivated us through the brutal SEAL training course and through a decade of constant deployments. We are not superheroes, but we all share a common bond in serving something greater than ourselves. It is a brotherhood that ties us together, and that bond is what allows us to willingly walk into harm's way together. This is the story of a group of extraordinary men who I was lucky enough to serve alongside as a SEAL from 1998 to 2012. I've changed the names of all the characters, including myself, to protect our identities, and this book does not include details of any ongoing missions. I've also taken great pains to protect the tactics, techniques, and procedures used by the teams as they wage a daily battle against terrorists and insurgents around the world. If you are looking for secrets, this is not your book. Although I am writing this book in an effort to accurately describe real-world events as they occurred, it is important to me that no classified information is released. With the assistance of my publisher, I hired a former special operations attorney to review the manuscript to ensure that it was free from mention of forbidden topics and that it cannot be used by sophisticated enemies as a source of sensitive information to compromise or harm the United States. I'm confident that the team that has worked with me on this book has both maintained and promoted the security interests of the United States. When I refer to other military or government organizations, activities, or agencies, I do so in the interest of continuity, and normally only if another publication or official unclassified government document has already mentioned that organization's participation in the mission I'm describing. I sometimes refer to certain publicly recognized senior military leaders by their true names, only when it is clear that there are no operational security issues involved. In all other cases, I have intentionally depersonalized the stories to maintain the anonymity of the individuals involved. I do not describe any technologies that would compromise the security of the United States. All of the material contained within this book is derived from unclassified publications and sources. Nothing written here is intended to confirm or deny, officially or unofficially, any events described or the activities of any individual, government, or agency. In an effort to protect the nature of specific operations, I sometimes generalize dates, times, and order of events. None of these workarounds affect the accuracy of my recollections or my description of how events unfolded. The operations discussed in this book have been written about in numerous other civilian and government publications and are available in open sources to the general public. The events depicted in No Easy Day are based on my own memory. Conversations have been reconstructed from my recollections. War is chaotic, but I've done my best to ensure that the stories in this book are accurate. If there are inaccuracies in it, the responsibility is mine. This book presents my views and does not represent the views of the United States Navy, the U.S. Department of Defense, or anyone else. In spite of the deliberate measures I have undertaken to protect the national security of the United States and the operational security of the men and women who continue to fight around the world, I believe No Easy Day to be an accurate portrayal of the events it describes and an honest portrayal of life in the SEAL teams and the brotherhood that exists among us. While written in the first person, my experiences are universal, and I am no better or worse than any man I've served with. It was a long, hard decision to write this book, and some in the community will look down on me for doing so. However, it is time to set the record straight about one of the most important missions in U.S. military history. Lost in the media coverage of the Bin Laden raid is why and how the mission was successful. This book will finally give credit to those who earned it. The mission was a team effort, from the intelligence analysts who found Osama bin Laden to the helicopter pilots who flew us to Abbottabad to the men who assaulted the compound. No one man or woman was more important than another. No Easy Day is the story of the guys, the human toll we pay, and the sacrifices we make to do this dirty job. This book is about a brotherhood that existed long before I joined, and that will be around long after I'm gone. My hope is one day a young man in junior high school will read it and become a SEAL, or at least live a life bigger than him. If that happens, this book is a success. Mark Owen, June 22, 2012, Virginia Beach, Virginia. Prologue. Chalk One. At 1 minute out, the Black Hawk crew chief slid the door open. I could just make him out, his night vision goggles covering his eyes, holding up one finger. I glanced around and saw my SEAL teammates calmly passing the sign throughout the helicopter. The roar of the engine filled the cabin, and it was now impossible to hear anything other than the Black Hawk's rotors beating the air. The wind buffeted me as I leaned out, scanning the ground below, hoping to steal a glance of the city of Abbottabad. An hour and a half before, we boarded our two MH-60 Blackhawks and lifted off into a moonless night. It was only a short flight from our base in Jalalabad, Afghanistan, to the border with Pakistan, and from there another hour to the target we had been studying on satellite images for weeks. The cabin was pitch black, except for the lights from the cockpit. I had been wedged against the left door with no room to stretch out. We'd stripped the helicopter of its seats to save on weight, so we either sat on the floor or on small camp chairs purchased at a local sporting goods store before we left. Now perched on the edge of the cabin, I stretched my legs out the door, trying to get the blood flowing. My legs were numb and cramped. Crowded into the cabin around me and in the second helicopter were 23 of my teammates from the Naval Special Warfare Development Group, or DEVGRU. I had operated with these men dozens of times before, some I had known 10 years or more. I trusted each one completely. 5 minutes ago, the whole cabin had come alive. We pulled on our helmets and checked our radios and then made one final check of our weapons. I was wearing 60 pounds of gear, each gram meticulously chosen for a specific purpose, my load refined and calibrated over a dozen years and hundreds of similar missions. This team had been hand-picked, assembled of the most experienced men in our squadron. Over the last 48 hours, as Go Day loomed and then was postponed and then loomed again, we had each checked and rechecked our equipment so we were more than ready for this night. This was a mission I'd dreamt about since I watched the September 11, 2001 attacks on a TV in my barracks room in Okinawa. I was just back from training and got into my room in time to see the second plane crash into the World Trade Center. I couldn't turn away as the fireball shot out of the opposite side of the building and smoke billowed out of the tower. Like millions of Americans back home, I stood there watching in disbelief, with a hopeless feeling in the pit of my stomach. I stayed transfixed to the screen for the rest of the day, as my mind tried to make sense of what I'd just witnessed. One plane crash could be an accident. The unfolding news coverage confirmed what I had known the moment the second plane entered the TV shot. A second plane was an attack. No doubt. No way that happened by accident. On September 11th, 2001, I was on my first deployment as a SEAL, and as Osama bin Laden's name was mentioned, I figured my unit would get the call to go to Afghanistan the next day. For the previous year and a half, we'd been training to deploy. We'd trained in Thailand, the Philippines, East Timor, and Australia over the last few months. As I watched the attacks, I longed to be out of Okinawa and in the mountains of Afghanistan chasing Al-Qaeda fighters and serving up a little payback. We never got the call. I was frustrated. I hadn't trained so hard and for so long to become a SEAL, only to watch the war on TV. Of course, I wasn't about to let my family and friends in on my frustration. They were asking me if I was going to Afghanistan. To them, I was a SEAL, and it was only logical that we would be immediately deployed to Afghanistan. I remember that I sent an email to my girlfriend at the time, trying to make light of a bad situation. We were talking about the end of this deployment and making plans for my time at home before the next deployment. "I've got about a month left," I wrote. "I'll be home soon, unless I have to kill bin Laden first." It was the kind of joke you heard a lot back then. Now, as the Blackhawks flew toward our target, I thought back over the last 10 years. Ever since the attacks, everyone in my line of work had dreamt of being involved in a mission like this. The Al-Qaeda leader personified everything we were fighting against. He'd inspired men to fly planes into buildings filled with innocent civilians. That kind of fanaticism is scary, and as I watched the towers crumble and saw reports of attacks in Washington, D.C. and Pennsylvania, I knew we were at war, and not a war of our choosing. A lot of brave men had sacrificed for years to fight the war, never knowing if we would get a chance to be involved in a mission like the one about to begin. A decade after that event, and with 8 years of chasing and killing Al-Qaeda leaders, we were minutes away from fast-roping into bin Laden's compound. Grabbing the rope attached to the Blackhawk's fuselage, I could feel the blood finally returning to my toes. The sniper next to me slid into place with one leg hanging outside and one leg inside the helicopter so that there was more room in the already tight doorway. The barrel of his weapon was scanning for targets in the compound. His job was to cover the south side of the compound as the assault team fast-roped into the courtyard and split up to our assignments. Just over a day ago, none of us had believed Washington would approve the mission. But after weeks of waiting, we were now less than a minute from the compound. The intelligence said our target would be there. I figured he was, but nothing would surprise me. We'd thought we were close a couple times before. I had spent a week in 2007 chasing rumors of bin Laden. We had received reports that he was coming back into Afghanistan from Pakistan for a final stand. A source said he'd seen a man in flowing white robes in the mountains. After weeks of prep, it was ultimately a wild goose chase. This time felt different. Before we left, the CIA analyst, who was the main force behind tracking the target to Abbottabad, said she was 100% certain he was there. I hope she was right, but my experience told me to reserve judgment until the mission was over. It didn't matter now. We were seconds away from the house, and whoever was living in there was about to have a bad night. We had completed similar assaults countless times before. For the last 10 years, I had deployed to Iraq, Afghanistan, and to the Horn of Africa. We had been part of the mission to rescue Richard Phillips, the captain of the container ship Maersk Alabama, from three Somali pirates in 2009, and I had operated in Pakistan before. Tactically, tonight was no different from 100 other operations. Historically, I hoped it was going to be very different. As soon as I gripped the rope, a calm came over me. Everyone on the mission had heard that one-minute call 1,000 times before, and at this point it was no different than any other operation. From the door of the helicopter, I started to make out landmarks I recognized from studying satellite images of the area during our weeks of training. I wasn't clipped into the helicopter with a safety line, so my teammate Walt had a hand on a nylon loop on the back of my body armor. Everybody was crowding toward the door right behind me, ready to follow me down. On the right side, my teammates had a good visual of the trail helicopter with Chalk 2 heading to its landing zone. As soon as we cleared the southeastern wall, our helicopter flared out and started to hover near our predetermined insert point. Looking down 30 feet into the compound, I could see laundry whipping on a clothesline. Rugs hung out to dry were battered by dust and dirt from the rotors. Trash swirled around the yard, and in a nearby animal pen, goats and cows thrashed around, startled by the helicopter. Focused on the ground, I could see we were still over the guest house. As the helicopter rocked, I could tell the pilot was having some trouble getting the aircraft into position. We veered between the roof of the guest house and the wall of the compound. Glancing over at the crew chief, I could see he had his radio microphone pressed against his mouth, passing directions to the pilot. The helicopter was bucking as it tried to find enough air to set a stable hover-and-hold station. The wobbling wasn't violent, but I could tell it wasn't planned. The pilot was fighting the controls, trying to correct it. Something wasn't right. The pilots had done this kind of mission so many times that for them, putting a helicopter over a target was like parking a car. Staring into the compound, I considered throwing the rope just so we could get out of the unstable bird. I knew it was a risk, but getting on the ground was imperative. There wasn't anything I could do stuck in the door of the helicopter. All I needed was a clear spot to throw the rope. But the clear spot never came. "We're going around, we're going around," I heard over the radio. That meant the original plan to fast rope into the compound was now off. We were going to circle around at the south, land, and assault from outside the wall. It would add precious time to the assault and allow anyone inside the compound more time to arm themselves. My heart sank. Up until I heard the go-around call, everything was going as planned. We had evaded the Pakistani radar and anti-aircraft missiles on the way in and arrived undetected. Now, the insert was already going to shit. We had rehearsed this contingency, but it was Plan B. If our target was really inside, surprise was the key, and it was quickly slipping away. As the helicopter attempted to climb out of its unstable hover, it took a violent right turn, spinning 90 degrees. I could feel the tail kick to the left. It caught me by surprise, and I immediately struggled to find a handhold inside the cabin to keep from sliding out the door. I could feel my butt coming off the floor, and for a second I could feel a panic rising in my chest. I let go of the rope and started to lean back into the cabin, but my teammates were all crowded in the door. There was little room for me to scoot back. I could feel Walt's grip tighten on my body armor as the helicopter started to drop. Walt's other hand held the sniper's gear. I leaned back as far as I could. Walt was practically lying on top of me to keep me inside. "Holy fuck, we're going in," I thought. The violent turn put my door in the front as the helicopter started to slide sideways. I could see the wall of the courtyard coming up at us. Overhead, the engines, which had been humming, now seemed to scream as they tried to beat the air into submission to stay aloft. The tail rotor had barely missed hitting the guest house as the helicopter slid to the left. We had joked before the mission that our helicopter had the lowest chance of crashing because so many of us had already survived previous helicopter crashes. We'd been sure if a helicopter was going to crash, it would be the one carrying Chalk too. Thousands of man-hours, maybe even millions, had been spent leading the United States to this moment, and the mission was about to go way off track before we even had a chance to get our feet on the ground. I tried to kick my legs up and wiggle deeper into the cabin. If the helicopter hit on its side, it might roll, trapping my legs under the fuselage. Leaning back as far as I could, I pulled my legs into my chest. Next to me, the sniper tried to clear his legs from the door, but it was too crowded. There was nothing we could do but hope the helicopter didn't roll and chop off his exposed leg. Everything slowed down. I tried to push the thoughts of being crushed out of my mind. With every second, the ground got closer and closer. I felt my whole body tense up, ready for the inevitable impact. Chapter 1. Green Team. I could feel the sweat dripping down my back, soaking my shirt, as I slowly moved down the corridor of the kill house at our training site in Mississippi. It was 2004, 7 years before I would ride a Black Hawk into Abbottabad, Pakistan, on one of the most historic special operations raids in history. I was in the selection and training course for SEAL Team 6, sometimes called by its full name, The United States Naval Special Warfare Development Group, abbreviated DEVGRU. The 9-month selection course was known as Green Team, and it was the one thing that stood between me and the other candidates moving up to the elite DEVGRU. My heart was beating fast, and I had to blink the perspiration out of my eyes as I followed my teammate to the door. My breathing was labored and ragged as I tried to force any extraneous thoughts from my head. I was nervous and edgy, and that was how mistakes were made. I needed to focus, but no matter what was in the room we were about to enter, it paled compared to the cadre of instructors watching on the catwalk. All of the instructors were senior combat veterans from DEVGRU, hand-picked to train new operators. They held my future in their hands. "Just get to lunch," I muttered to myself. It was the only way I could control my anxiety. In 1998, I'd made it through basic underwater demolition SEAL, or BUDS, by focusing on just making it to the next meal. It didn't matter if I couldn't feel my arms as we hoisted logs over our heads, or if the cold surf soaked me to the core. It wasn't going to last forever. There is a saying, "How do you eat an elephant?" The answer is simple, one bite at a time. Only my bites were separated by meals. Make it to breakfast, train hard until lunch, and focus until dinner. Repeat. In 2004, I was already a SEAL, but making it to DEVGRU would be the pinnacle of my career. As the Navy's counterterrorism unit, DEVGRU did hostage rescue missions, tracked war criminals, and, since the attacks on September 11th, hunted and killed Al-Qaeda fighters in Afghanistan and Iraq. But nothing about making it through Green Team was easy. It was no longer good enough for me to be a SEAL. During Green Team, just passing was failing, and second place was the first loser. The point was not to meet the minimums, but crush them. Success in Green Team was about managing stress and performing at your peak level all the time. Before each training day, we completed a punishing physical training, or PT, workout of long runs, push-ups, pull-ups, and anything else the sadistic instructors could cook up. We pushed cars, and on multiple occasions, we pushed buses. When we got to the kill house, a purpose-built, ballistically safe building made up of hallways and rooms used to practice close-quarters battle, or CQB, our muscles were already tired and sore. The point of doing the PT was to make us physically tired, to simulate the stress of a real mission before they tested us in a demanding tactical environment. I didn't have time to steal a glimpse of the instructors as we moved down the hall. This was the first day of training, and everybody's nerves were running high. We had started CQB training after completing a full month's worth of high-altitude parachute training in Arizona. The pressure to perform had been evident there, too. But once we got to Mississippi, it was ratcheted up. I shook the nagging aches and pains from my mind and concentrated on the door in front of me. It was made of thin plywood with no doorknob. The door was battered and broken from teams that went before us, and my teammate easily pushed it open with his gloved hand. We paused for a second at the threshold, scanning for targets before we entered. The room was square, with rough walls made of old railroad ties to absorb the live rounds. I could hear my teammate enter behind me as I swept my rifle in an arc, searching for a target. Nothing. The room was empty. "Moving," my teammate called as he stepped into the room to clear around a corner. Instinctually, I slid into position to cover him. As soon as I started to move, I could hear murmuring above me in the rafters. We couldn't stop, but I knew one of us had just made a mistake. For a second, my stress level spiked, but I quickly pushed it out of my mind. There was no time to worry about mistakes. There were more rooms to clear. I couldn't worry about the mistakes I made in the first room. Back in the hall, we entered the next room. I spotted two targets as I entered. To the right, I saw the silhouette of a crook holding a small revolver. He was wearing a sweatshirt and looked like a 1970s thug from the movies. To the left, there was a silhouette of a woman holding a purse. I snapped a shot off at the crook seconds after stepping into the room. The round hit center mass. I moved toward it, shooting a few more rounds. "Clear," I said, lowering my muzzle. "Clear," my teammate answered.
"Save him and let him hang,"
one of the instructors said from above. No less than six instructors were looking down at us from a catwalk that spidered out over the kill house. They could walk safely along the walkways, watching as we cleared the different rooms, judging our performance and watching for any tiny mistakes. I put my rifle on safe and let it hang against me by its sling. I wiped beads of sweat out of my eyes with my sleeve. My heart was still pounding, even though we were finished. The training scenarios were pretty straightforward. We all knew how to clear rooms. It was the process of clearing a room perfectly under the simulated stress of combat that would set us apart. There was no margin of error, and at that moment, I wasn't sure exactly what we had done wrong. "Where was your move call?" Tom, one of the instructors, said to me from the catwalk. I didn't answer. I just nodded. I was embarrassed and disappointed. I'd forgotten to tell my teammate to move in the first room, which was a safety violation. Tom was one of the best instructors in the course. I could always pick him out because he had a huge head. It was massive, like it housed a giant brain. It was his one distinct physical trait. Otherwise, you'd miss him because he was mellow and never seemed to get upset. We all respected him because he was both firm and fair. When you made a mistake in front of Tom, it felt like you let him down. His disappointment with me was plastered across his face. No screaming, no yelling, just the look. From above, I saw him shoot me the, "Dude, really? Did you just do that?" look. I wanted to speak, or at least try and explain, but I knew they didn't want to hear it. If they said you were wrong, you were wrong. Standing below them in the empty room, there was no arguing or explaining. "Okay. Check," I said, defenseless and furious with myself for making such a basic error. "We need better than that," Tom said. "Beat it. Do your ladder climb." Snatching up my rifle, I jogged out of the kill house and sprinted to a rope ladder hanging on a tree about 300 yards away. Climbing up the ladder, rung by rung, I felt heavier. It wasn't my sweat-soaked shirt or the 60 pounds of body armor and gear strapped to my chest. It was my fear of failure. I've never failed anything in my SEAL career. When I got to San Diego 6 years earlier for BUDS, I never doubted I'd make it. A lot of my fellow BUDS candidates who arrived with me either got cut or quit. Some of them couldn't keep up with the brutal beach runs, or they panicked underwater during scuba training. Like a lot of other BUDS candidates, I knew I wanted to become a SEAL when I was 13. I read every book I could find about the SEALs, followed the news during Desert Storm for any mention of them, and daydreamed about ambushes and coming up over the beach on a combat mission. I wanted to do all of the things I'd read in the books while growing up. After completing my degree at a small college in California, I went to BUDS and earned my SEAL Trident in 1998. After a 6-month deployment throughout the Pacific Rim and a combat deployment to Iraq in 2003-2004, I was ready for something new. I'd learned about DevGru during my first two deployments. DevGru was a collection of the best the SEAL community had to offer, and I knew I would never be able to live with myself if I didn't try. The Navy's counterterrorism unit was born in the aftermath of Operation Eagle Claw, the failed 1980 mission ordered by President Jimmy Carter to rescue 52 Americans held captive at the U.S. Embassy in Tehran, Iran. After the mission, the Navy identified a need for a force capable of successfully executing those kind of specialized missions, and tapped Richard Marcinko to develop a maritime counterterrorism unit called SEAL Team 6. The team practiced hostage rescue, as well as infiltrating enemy countries, ships, naval bases, and oil rigs. Over time, missions branched out to counter proliferation of weapons of mass destruction. At the time Marcinko established the command, there were only two SEAL teams, so 6 was chosen to make the Soviets think the Navy had more teams. In 1987, SEAL Team 6 became DevGru. The unit started with 75 operators, hand-picked by Marcinko. Now, all of the members of the unit are hand-picked from other SEAL teams and explosive ordnance disposal units. The unit has grown significantly and filled out with numerous teams of operators as well as support staff, but the concept remains the same. The unit is part of the Joint Special Operations Command, called JSOC. DevGru works closely with other National Missions Force teams like the Army's Delta Force. One of the DevGru's first missions was in 1983 during Operation Urgent Fury. Members of the unit rescued Grenada's Governor General, Paul Scoon, during the U.S.-led invasion of the small Caribbean nation after a communist takeover. Scoon was facing execution. 6 years later, in 1989, Devgru joined with Delta Force to capture Manuel Noriega during the invasion of Panama. Devgru operators were part of the U.S.-led mission to capture Somali warlord Mohamed Farah Aidid in October 1993, which turned into the Battle of Mogadishu. The fight was chronicled in Mark Bowden's book, Black Hawk Down. In 1998, Devgru operators tracked Bosnian war criminals, including Radoslav Krstić, the Bosnian general, who was later indicted for his role in the Srebrenica massacre of 1995. Since September 11, 2001, Devgru operators had been on a steady cycle of deployments to Iraq and Afghanistan, targeting Al-Qaeda and Taliban commanders. The command got the immediate call to insert into Afghanistan after September 11, 2001, and operators in the command were responsible for some of the high-profile missions, like the Jessica Lynch rescue in Iraq in 2003. It was missions like these, and the fact that they are the first to get the call, that motivated me. Before you can screen for Green Team, you need to be a SEAL, and most candidates typically have two deployments. The deployments usually mean the candidate has the necessary skill level and experience which was needed to complete the selection course. As I climbed the rungs on the ladder in the Mississippi heat, I couldn't help but think about how I'd almost failed the 3-day screening process before even starting Green Team. The dates for the screening fell during my unit's land warfare training. I was at Camp Pendleton, California, hiding under a tree, watching Marines build a base camp. It was 2003, and we were a week into our reconnaissance training block when I got orders to report back to San Diego to start the 3-day screening process. If I was lucky enough to get selected, I would begin the 9-month Green Team training course. If I was lucky enough to pass it, I would join the ranks of DevGru. I was the only one in my platoon going. A buddy in a sister platoon was also screening. As we drove down together, we both were washing the green paint off our faces. Still dressed in our camouflage uniforms, we smelled of body odor and bug spray after spending days in the field. My stomach hurt from eating nothing but meals ready to eat, and I tried to hydrate, sucking down water as we drove. I was not in the best physical shape, and I knew the first part of the screening was a fitness test. The next morning, we were out at the beach. The sun was just peeking over the horizon as I finished the 4-mile timed run. After a short break, I joined about 24 other candidates in a line on a concrete pad. A breeze blew off the Pacific, and there was a little chill in the air from the night before. At any other time, it would have been a pretty morning on the beach. I was already tired from the run, and we still had push-ups, sit-ups, and pull-ups before the swim. I easily passed the push-up test, despite the instructors nitpicking each rep. Every exercise had to be perfect, or it didn't count. Rolling onto my back, I prepared for the sit-up test. I was really tired as I knocked out the first sit-ups. Being out in the field hadn't helped my stamina. I got into a good rhythm at first, but it was broken when the instructor stopped next to me and started repeating some of the numbers of my reps. 10, 10, 10, he said. 10, 11, 12, 12. My technique wasn't textbook. He was repeating the numbers that weren't perfect. Every time he repeated a number, I was more ashamed. I was getting tired, but I wasn't getting any closer to meeting the test standard. 1 minute. I was way behind as the call came, and I was quickly running out of time. If I failed the sit-ups, I was done. Doubt started to creep into my mind. I started to come up with bullshit excuses, like I was ill-prepared because I had been training with my unit rather than preparing for this test. 30 seconds! With half a minute to go, I was 10 short of the minimum number. Next to me, another guy had already passed that number, and he was knocking out even more as fast as he could go. My mind was spinning, and I couldn't believe I was failing. Forcing the poisonous thoughts from my mind, I focused on technique. Soon, I was making up ground. 10 seconds! I was close. My stomach ached. My breath came in gasps. My fatigue was replaced with fear. I was in shock. I couldn't fail. There was no way I could go back to my platoon knowing I couldn't even pass the physical fitness test. 5, 4, 3. As the instructors called time, I finished my last sit-up. I squeaked by, passing the minimum by 2 measly sit-ups. I was spent, but I still had to do the pull-ups. Walking to the bar, the near failure scared some adrenaline into me, and I was able to pass the pull-ups without issue. The final event was a swim in San Diego Bay. The water was calm. We had wetsuits on, so I couldn't feel the chill of the water. I started strong. One of the guys screening had been a Naval Academy swimmer and was well ahead of me, but I was in second place. I kept pulling, but it felt like I was going slow. It felt like swimming on a treadmill. When I got to the finish line, the instructors told me I'd failed. It turned out everyone except for the Academy swimmer failed. That caught the attention of the instructors, and they checked the tide schedule. After a quick review of the currents, word came down that we had been swimming against the tide. "We're going to do the whole test again tomorrow," they told us, to my relief. Part of the challenge was that you're tired by the time you get to each exercise, so we couldn't just repeat the swim. I knew I would have to do the sit-ups again, and in the back of my mind, I knew I wasn't going to get my abs in shape in one night. It was a mental thing. I went in there ready to kick ass the next day, and I willed my way to a passing score. I knew my scores weren't great, and I was concerned about how they'd be received during the oral board the next day. Just because I passed the minimum scores didn't mean anything in the big scheme of things. This was a selection course for the best of the best, and I was not showing the instructors that I was prepared. I arrived early for my interview in my dress blue uniform with all of my ribbons and awards. I'd gotten a haircut the day before and made sure my shave was close. I looked like a diagram out of a uniform textbook. It was one of the rare times I knew a haircut, shine shoes, and a pressed uniform really mattered for a SEAL. At least it gave the instructors one less thing to pick on during the board. Inside the conference room was a long table at the far end. Seated at the table were a half dozen Master Chiefs, a psychologist who had tested us the second day of screening, and a career counselor. A single chair sat in front of the board. I walked into the room and took a seat. For the next 45 minutes, they took turns lobbing questions at me. I'd never been under fire like this. I didn't know that before I arrived. The board had already talked to my platoon chief and commander at SEAL Team 5. They had an idea of who I was, but this was the only time they'd get a chance to size me up in person. To this day, I can't remember who sat on my oral board. To me, they were just high-ranking operators who held my future in their hands. It was up to me to convince them to select me. But my poor physical fitness score wasn't helping my case. "Do you know who you were screening for?" one of the chiefs said. "Do you know what you're trying out to do? This is the entry-level test. You're getting ready for the big leagues here, and this is what you show?" I didn't hesitate. I knew they'd hit me on this, and I only had one play. "I take full responsibility," I said. "I am embarrassed to sit here and show you that PT score. All I can tell you is, if I show up, if I am selected, those scores are never going to happen again. I am not going to give you any excuses. That is on me. It is on nobody but myself." I searched their faces to see if they believed me. There was no indication if they did or not. All I got were blank stares. The barrage of questions continued, designed to keep me off balance. They wanted to see if I could keep my composure. If I can't sit in a chair and answer questions, then what am I going to do under fire? If they wanted to make me uncomfortable, they succeeded, but mostly, I was embarrassed. These were people who I looked up to and aspired to be like, and here I was, a young SEAL who had barely passed his sit-up test. At the end of the board, they dismissed me. "We'll let you know within the next 6 months if you have been selected." As I left the room, I figured I had a 50-50 chance of making it. Back at Camp Pendleton, I smeared fresh green paint on my face and snuck back into the field to join my teammates for the last few days of the training mission. "How did it go?" my chief asked when I linked up with the team. "I don't know," I said. I wasn't telling anyone about the fitness test. I knew there was a real chance I had failed. I was in the middle of my SEAL Team 5 deployment to Iraq when I finally got the news. My platoon chief called me into our operations center. "You screened positive," he said. "You'll be getting orders to Green Team when we get back." I was shocked because in my mind I had been preparing myself for the worst. I had it in my head I would have to rescreen. Now that I'd been selected, I was committed to not making the same mistakes. I knew I would show up at Green Team prepared. Chapter 2. Top 5, Bottom 5. My lungs burned and my legs ached as I ran back from the ladder in the humid Mississippi summer. The pain was less physical and more about pride. I was screwing up. The pressure I was putting on myself was worse than anything I'd hear from the instructors. The mistake I'd made in the kill house was a result of losing focus, and I knew that was unacceptable. I knew I wouldn't be in the course much longer if I couldn't block out the pressure and focus on the tasks at hand. Candidates could get cut from the course on any given day. I ran back and stood outside the house. I could hear the crack of rifle fire inside as other teams cleared rooms. We had a few minutes to catch our breath before going back in for yet another iteration. Tom had climbed down from the catwalk and was outside when I got back. He pulled me aside. "Hey, brother," he said. "It was exactly the right move in there. You covered your buddy. But there was no moving call."
"Check," I said.
"I know back in your old command you guys did things your way and maybe you didn't need the call there," Tom said. "But here, we want textbook CQB and we want the verbiage we asked for. If you are lucky to complete this training and go to an assault squadron on the second deck, trust me, you won't be doing basic CQB. But here, under pressure, you need to prove to us that you can do even the most basic CQB. We have a standard and you can't move without a moving call." The second deck was where all of the assault squadrons worked at the command back in Virginia Beach. During our first days in Green Team, we were told we were not allowed to go up to the second floor of the building. It was off limits until graduation. So getting to the second deck was the goal. It was the prize. I nodded and slid a new magazine into my rifle. That night I grabbed a cold beer and spread my cleaning kit out on the table. I took a long pull and savored the fact I survived another bite out of the proverbial elephant. I was one step closer to the second deck. During our CQB block of training, we lived in two large houses located near the shooting ranges and kill house. They were basically massive barracks beat to hell after hundreds of SEAL and Special Forces training rotations. The rooms were filled with bunk beds, but I spent most of my time downstairs in the lounge area. There was a pool table and a 1980s big screen TV, usually tuned to a sporting event. It was more background noise as guys cleaned their weapons or shot pool and tried to unwind. The SEAL community is small. We all know each other, or have at least heard of one another. From the day you step onto the beach to start buds, you are building a reputation. Everybody talks about reputation from day one. "Saw you on the ladder today," Charlie said to me as he racked up the balls for another game of pool. "What did you fuck up?" Charlie was big in both stature and wit. He was a huge man, with hands the size of shovels and giant shoulders. Standing about 6'4" tall, he weighed in at 230 pounds. His mouth was as big as his body. He kept up a steady stream of smack talk day and night. We called him the Bully. A former deck seaman, Charlie grew up in the Midwest and joined the Navy after graduation. He spent about a year chipping paint and brawling with his crewmates in the fleet before going to Buds. The way Charlie told it, being out in the fleet was like being in a gang. He told stories about fights on the ship and in port or on cruise. He hated being on the ships and wanted nothing more than to become a SEAL. Charlie was one of the top candidates in the class. He was consistently smart and aggressive, and it didn't hurt that his last job before Green Team was as a CQB instructor for the East Coast SEAL teams. The kill houses came naturally to him, and he was a crack shot to boot. "No move call," I said. "Keep it up and you'll be back in San Diego working on that tan," he said. "At least you'll be ready for the next year's calendar." SEALs are based in two places, San Diego, California, and Virginia Beach, Virginia. A healthy rivalry existed between the two groups, based mostly on geography and demographics. The difference between the teams is minimal. Teams on both coasts did the same missions and had the same skill set, but West Coast SEALs have the reputation of being laid-back surfers, and the East Coast guys are thought of as Carhartt-wearing rednecks.
I was a West Coast SEAL, so hanging with Charlie meant a steady diet of digs, especially about the calendar.
Right, Mr. May? Charlie said, snickering.
I didn't appear in it, but some of the teammates put out a calendar a few years back for charity. The pictures were cringeworthy shots of guys without shirts on the beach or near the gray-hulled ships in San Diego. The move may have helped feed the poor or fight cancer, but it brought on years of mocking from the East Coast teams.
No one wants to make a calendar of pasty white East Coast guys, I said. I'm sorry if we have our shirts off enjoying the sunny San Diego weather.
It was a battle that would never end. We'll settle this on the range tomorrow, I said. My fallback was always shooting. I didn't have the wit to go up against Charlie or the other smooth talkers in Green Team. It was widely known that my jokes were always weak. It was better to beat a quick retreat and then do my best to outshoot those guys the next day. I was an above-average shot, since I'd pretty much grown up with a gun in my hand during my childhood in Alaska. My parents never let me play with toy guns because by the time I was finished with elementary school, I was carrying a .22 rifle. From an early age, I knew the responsibility of handling a firearm. For our family, a gun was a tool.
You need to respect the gun and respect what it can do, my father told me.
He taught me how to shoot and be safe with my rifle. But that didn't mean I didn't learn that lesson the hard way before it completely stuck with me. After one hunting trip with my father, it was freezing out, too cold to stand outside and clear our rifles. I joined the rest of my family in the house. My mother was in the kitchen preparing dinner. My sisters were at the kitchen table playing a game. I pulled off my gloves and started to clear my rifle. My father had taught me how to clear the chamber several times, emphasizing safety. First, take out the magazine, and then work the action to eject any rounds before looking in the chamber, and then dry firing in a safe direction into the ground. On this particular occasion, I wasn't paying attention, and I must have chambered a round, and then I slid the magazine out. Pointing the gun toward the floor, I took it off safe and squeezed the trigger. The bullet exploded from the barrel and buried itself into the floor in front of the wood stove. I hadn't been paying attention because I was trying to warm up. The boom echoed throughout the house. I froze. My heart was beating so hard it hurt my chest. My hands were shaking. I looked at my father, who was looking at the tiny hole in the floor. My mother and sisters came running over to see what happened.
You okay? My father asked.
I stammered a yes and checked the rifle to make sure it was clear. With my hands still shaking, I put the rifle down. I'm sorry, I said. I forgot to check the chamber. I was more embarrassed than anything else. I knew how to handle my rifle, but I'd gotten careless because I was more focused on getting warm. My father cleared his own rifle and hung up his coat. He wasn't angry, he just wanted to make sure I knew what happened. Kneeling down next to me with my rifle, we went through the steps again.
What did you do wrong?
Talk me through it, he said. Take the magazine out, I said. Clear the chamber, check it. Take it off safe and pull the trigger in a safe direction. I showed him how to clear it properly a couple of times, and then we hung the gun in the rack near the door. It takes only one time to screw things up, and I learned from it. It was a huge lesson, and I never forgot again. Just like I never forgot another moving, move call after that day in the kill house. Our daily schedule in Green Team during the CQB portion started at dawn. We worked out as a class each morning. Then, for the rest of the day, half of the 30-man class would go to the range, and the other half would go to the kill house. At lunch, we'd switch. The ranges were some of the best in the world. This wasn't your basic range where you shot at targets from a line. No, we'd race through obstacles, fire from the skeletons of burnt-out cars, and do a set of pull-ups before racing to shoot a series of targets. We always seemed to be moving. We already had the basics down. We were learning to shoot in combat. The instructors worked to get our heart rates up so that we had to control our breathing while we shot. Our training facility had two kill houses. One was made of stacked railroad ties. It had a few long hallways and basic square rooms. The newer house was modular and could be reconfigured to resemble conference rooms, bathrooms, and even a ballroom. We rarely saw the same layout more than once. The goal was to throw something new at us each day to see how we handled it. The pace of training was fast. The instructors didn't wait for people to catch up. It was a speeding train, and if you didn't catch on by the first day, you would most likely be heading back to your previous unit in very short order. Like a reality show, each week our numbers grew smaller as guys washed out. It was all part of preparing us for the real world and ferreting out the gray man. He was the guy who blended into the group. Never the best guy, but also not the worst. The gray man always met the standards, exceeding them rarely, and stayed invisible. To root out the gray man, the instructors gave us a few minutes at the end of the week to perform peer rankings. We sat at beat-up picnic tables under an awning. The instructors gave each one of us a piece of paper. "Top five, bottom five, gentlemen," one of the instructors said. "You've got 5 minutes." We each had to make an anonymous list of the 5 best performers in the class and the 5 worst. The instructors didn't see us all hours of the day, so top 5, bottom 5 allowed them to get a better sense of who was really performing well. A candidate could be a great shot and do everything perfectly in the kill house, but outside of training, he wouldn't be easy to work with or live with. The instructors took our top 5, bottom 5 and compared them with their lists. Our assessment contributed to the fate of a candidate because it drew a clearer picture of the student. At the beginning, it was kind of obvious who the bottom 5 were in the class. It was easy to see the weak links. But as those guys started to disappear, it wasn't so easy to pick the bottom 5 anymore. Charlie was always in my top 5. So was Steve. Like Charlie, Steve was an East Coast SEAL. I used to hang out with Steve and Charlie on the weekends and during our training trips. If Steve wasn't working, he was reading. Mostly nonfiction, with an emphasis on current events and politics. He also had a decent stock portfolio, which he monitored on his laptop during the few hours of downtime. Not only was he an outstanding SEAL, he could talk politics, investing, and football at the same level. He was thick, not lean like a swimmer, but more like a linebacker. Charlie used to joke that Steve looked like a groundhog. He was one of the few who routinely kicked my ass with a pistol. At the end of each day, I would always check his score to see if he beat me. Like Charlie, Steve had been a CQB instructor for the East Coast teams before coming to Green Team. He had 3 deployments, and he was one of the few East Coast guys with any combat experience. At that time, only West Coast teams had deployed to Iraq or Afghanistan. Steve had deployed to Bosnia in the late 1990s, and his team got into a firefight, one of the few before September 11th. Charlie and Steve always seemed to end up on the top of my list. As more and more guys washed out, it became harder and harder to fill my bottom 5. "Coming up with bottom 5 is kicking my ass," I said to Steve one night. We were both sitting at the table in the range house cleaning our rifles. "Who were your bottom 5 last week?" he said. I rattled off some names, many of the same guys on Steve's list. "I don't know who to put down this week," I said. "Ever think of putting yourself down there?" Steve said. "I got 3 names. The last 2, I don't know," I said. "I guess we could use our own names. I don't want to throw someone else under the bus." I didn't think either of us was doing badly in the class. "I'm going to risk it," Steve said. "We need 5 names." A few weeks earlier, we tried to leave the bottom 5 blank. As a class, we decided to rebel and stand up to the instructors. It didn't last long. We spent the rest of the night running and pushing cars for hours instead of unwinding after a long day of training. That Friday, I put my own name down on the bottom 5. So did Steve. He was willing to stand up for what was right. Steve was a leader in the class, and when he came up with ideas, guys listened. By the end of the CQB block of training in Mississippi, we had lost about a third of the class. The guys who washed out couldn't process information fast enough to make the correct split-second decision. It wasn't that they were bad guys, because a lot would rescreen and make it through on their second try. Those who didn't would go back to their regular teams, where they'd typically excel. The rumor around the command was, if you passed the CQB block of training, you had a more than 50-50 chance of passing Green Team. The instructors heard the same rumor, so when we got back to Virginia Beach, they kept the pressure on, never letting us forget that we were a very long way from being done. We were only 3 months into a 9-month training course. The next 6 months wouldn't be any easier. After CQB, we went on to train on explosive breaching, land warfare, and communications. One of the SEAL team's core jobs is shipboarding, called underways. We spent weeks practicing boarding a variety of boats, from cruise ships to cargo vessels. Although we spent a lot of time in Afghanistan and Iraq, we needed to be proficient in the water. We rehearsed over-the-beach operations, where we would swim through the surf zone and patrol over the beach and conduct a raid. Afterward, we'd disappear into the ocean, linking up with our boats offshore. During the last month of training, we practiced VIP security details. Afghan President Hamid Karzai's first security detail were SEALs from the command. We also attended an advanced course in SEER, or Survival Evasion Resistance and Escape. The key to the course was managing stress. The instructors kept everyone tired and on edge, forcing us to make important decisions under the worst conditions. It was the only way the instructors could mimic combat. Success or failure of our missions was a direct reflection of how each operator could process information in a stressful environment. Green Team was different than BUDS because I knew just passing the swim or run and being cold all without quitting wasn't enough. Green Team was about mental toughness. During this time, we were also learning the culture of the command. Throughout Green Team, we were on a 1-hour recall to simulate what we would experience on the second deck. If recalled, the pager buzzed and we had an hour to get back to work and check in. Every day at 6 o'clock, we got a test page. The pagers became another source of pressure the instructors used. Several times we'd get pages before dawn to come into work. One Sunday around midnight, my pager went off. Still shaking the sleep from my head, I rolled into the base in time and was told to put on my PT gear and stand by. We were going to have a PT test. We weren't supposed to be more than an hour away and couldn't drink to intoxication. We had to be able to perform when called upon. We could get a page and be on a plane to anywhere in the world within hours. Soon, my teammates started to arrive. Some seemed like the page had interrupted a trip to the bar. "Are you drunk right now?" I heard an instructor ask another candidate. "Of course not, I just had a beer at the house," he said. As the hour ticked away, I still didn't see Charlie. He rolled in about 20 minutes late. The instructors were pissed. He'd gotten a ticket for speeding on his way, which only delayed him more. Thankfully, it was just a verbal lashing from the instructors, and Charlie was able to stay with our class. With only weeks left in the 9-month training, we started to hear rumors about the draft. To fill out the squadrons, the instructors would rank the whole class, and then assault squadron master chiefs would sit around a table and pick new members from my Green Team class. The individual squadrons were in a constant state of flux as they rotated from deployment overseas to months of training, and then months on standby, during which a call to deploy could come at any time. After the draft, the Green Team instructors posted a list. A whole bunch of my friends, including me, Charlie, and Steve, were going to the same squadron. "Hey, congrats," Tom said when he saw me looking at the list. "When I'm done with my instructor time, I'm going back to that squadron to be a team leader." SEALs are deployed around the world at any given time. The heart of each squadron are the teams, each led by a senior enlisted SEAL and made up of a half dozen operators apiece. The teams make up troops, which are led by a lieutenant commander. Multiple troops make up a squadron, led by a commander. DEVGRU assault squadrons are augmented by intelligence analysts and support personnel. When you get to a team, you slowly work your way up the chain. Most of the time, you stay in the same team, unless you get tapped to be a Green Team instructor or work a collateral duty. The day after the draft, I brought my gear up to the second deck. I followed Steve and Charlie to the squadron team room. The room was large, with a small bar and kitchen area in one corner. Everyone had brought a case of beer, a tradition when you show up at the squadron for the first time. Our squadron was getting ready to go on standby and then deploy to Afghanistan. Some of my teammates from Green Team were already packing their gear and deploying as brand new assaulters with their respective squadrons. Along one wall, the commander and master chief had offices. A massive table took up most of the room, with smaller tables with computers along the perimeter. Flat screens that were used in briefings hung on one wall. The rest of the wall space was filled with plaques from other units, like the Australian SAS, and mementos from past missions. A bloody hood and flex cuffs were mounted on a plaque on the wall after the squadron captured a Bosnian war criminal in the 1990s. Petty Officer First Class Neil Roberts's squad automatic weapon, or